David, can you hear me okay?
I can.
All right. I know you're in Tacoma. I'm in Seattle, but I'm going to play a little bit of music for you that's been stuck in my head lately.
Nah, 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 come on.
So this song by Rihanna, I find simultaneously irritating and weirdly compelling. And it's got me thinking, what is it about repetition in music that is so pleasing to the ear and to the human brain? I'm Gabriel Spitzer, by the way. And David Deacon-Joyner, I'm asking you because you're a music professor at Pacific Lutheran University. And I thought you might have some insight into this. What is it about repetition?
Just like any good jingle or any good song or any good advertisement, the more you can hear it in a short amount of time, the less chance you're going to forget it, for better or for worse.
And is this like a product of the dance club? I mean, is this a new pop music sort of a phenomenon, or does it go back farther?
It goes back a long way. Most of the world's folk musics are very repetitious and linked with perhaps some sort of ceremonial or spiritual activity that's supposed to take you into a trance-like state, an altered state of consciousness, or a state of euphoria. It's very interesting to see that from the laboring songs of African Americans in the early part of the 20th century, I'm thinking specifically of work songs, and a work song is defined by doing some kind of synchronized task that creates a beat, for instance, driving nails into a railroad track. They're looking for a state of euphoria because they're doing back-breaking work and they're trying to lift themselves out of it.
Is there something really basic about this predisposition toward repetition? I mean, our brains are pattern recognition machines, right?
Right.
Do you think that is behind why we're so drawn to repetition in music, but also in art and in photography and dance?
Absolutely. I think we need repetition. We need reinforcement to reassure us. The musicians have always said that we are rhythmic beings, that even in the womb we hear the pattern of our mother's heartbeat. And I'm sure that we have that embedded in our most basic being.
Well, because repetition is so fundamental to who we are and what we like to hear, we here at Sound Effect are going to bring you some repeats this week. So this week, repetition of some of our favorite segments from our first 4 months on the air. Ordinarily, of course, we have a panel of journalists in to help us break down the week's news. They will be back next week. So for now, stick around for some of our favorite stories from our first few months of Sound Effect right here on KPLU. So for our first repeat, we are going to go all the way back to our first show. And the theme of that show was newness. Now, when you think about getting something new, it can often seem like kind of a luxury. But for Layla Mirhadari, it was anything but a luxury. It was life or death. So Layla lives in Gig Harbor. And about 3 years ago, she was a student at Washington State University. And she noticed that she started to feel kind of sick, you know, just low energy. She was bruising easily. And then she woke up one day and she discovered that there were these weird gray spots in her field of vision, and everything was just kind of blurry.
Went to optometrist. He took pictures of the back of my eye, told me that they were bleeding. Then next day went in, got lab work done. That night around 10:30, I got a call from the lab tech saying I needed to get into a hospital, that he couldn't tell me what was going on, but it had something to do with my kidneys.
So she went back to the hospital there in Pullman, got, you know, poked, prodded, more lab work done, and finally the doctor gave her the news.
The physician came in, sat down quietly, and told me that my kidneys had failed, that I had, you know, maybe about 5% left. I didn't know if I was going to live to see tomorrow, or I was an organ failure.
So this, as you might expect, was something of a shock, because I don't know if I mentioned this, but she was only 27 years old, and that just doesn't happen to 27-year-olds. You don't just go into organ failure for no reason. And it has remained kind of a mystery. No one's quite sure what happened to her kidneys. As best she can figure out, you know, she had had the swine flu some months earlier, and it's possible that infection kind of bounced around inside her body. But the bottom line was she needed help, and she needed it right away.
So they were like, you need dialysis, and you need it now.
Dialysis.
Yes.
So that was a new word to you then.
Yes. Yes. I had no idea what the world of dialysis meant. Yeah.
So what does it mean? To describe it for somebody who's never had the pleasure.
Well, there's two different kinds of dialysis. Hemodialysis, which is, you know, a blood cleansing. And then there's peritoneal dialysis, where you use a catheter put in my abdomen and a fluid exchange. But you go in center, you go three times a week. I went in like Monday, Wednesday, Friday for 3 to 4 hours. And you sit in a chair and, you know, blood's being pumped out of you and going through this artificial filter and then being pumped back in you.
So in center, that means you go into a special place.
Right.
Doctors and nurses do this stuff for you. But
right.
then eventually you, this whole operation came home with you, right?
Correct. Yeah. And so after about a couple months of being in center, once my catheter healed, I went through about 2.5 months of training where I went in multiple times a week. You learn, you know, everything there is to learn to be your own nurse at home. Yeah.
So walk me through it. Like, what was your routine like and how often did you have to do it?
So I did it every day. 8 hours a night, I would have to hook up to my machine.
While you're sleeping?
Yes, or try to sleep is what I always told people. You know, you can feel the pressure of fluid being put in and out of your stomach. So,
Is it cold?
It isn't, because the machine had a warmer. But if it was ever cold, you could instantly feel it. You would cramp and it would be very uncomfortable. But I would normally have around 2 liters in my abdomen, you know, at a time. So that's a lot of fluid. You know, sometimes I would feel like I would look, you know, like 6 months pregnant, but it would just be all fluid that would be in my stomach, you know, and you kind of feel full and uncomfortable.
What was this like for you just to experience this, particularly as a person? And I mean, it couldn't be fun for anybody, but
no.
For somebody in her late 20s,
right.
How did it feel? And how did it feel watching all your peers not going through that?
Right. It was hard at first. I was definitely jealous of a lot of my friends that, you know, if we would go out or have a good time. I was also on a very strict diet, so there were things that I couldn't eat. I didn't have a lot of energy. I always felt kind of ill and sick. So that, yeah, it was hard. And then my friends could just go home and crash on their bed or crash on the couch, and you know, they didn't have that huge responsibility when they got home.
Yeah, it's not like you could just flop over on the Lazy Boy
no.
and fall asleep for the night.
No. No, it would take probably about a good half an hour or so just to say, okay, now I can go to bed.
How long did that go on?
For 3 years.
Did you feel chained to this thing?
Oh, yeah. In the absolute physical sense of it, yes. Because once you hook up to your dialysis machine, you really have maybe enough tether to get to the bathroom, if that's it. So once I would be on this machine for 8 hours, I couldn't leave the bedroom.
So all that time, you were, of course, waiting for another kidney,
yes.
A new kidney.
Yes.
Right? So how did that work exactly?
Yes, it's this, you know, this phantom thing that you never know is going to come, but you just have to have hope that one day, you know, this magical kidney will come. And, of course, the wait in Washington is around 2 to 3 years, which is actually pretty good considering there's some states that can be up to 5 to 7 years. So then I kind of thought, hey, you know, maybe I should start looking for a living donor. And how do you ask somebody, hey, can I have your kidney? It's kind of an interesting intro to a conversation. Had a couple people come forward, but weren't really that serious. And then luckily in November of last year, I guess you could call him my step-cousin, had seen what I was going through and was like, hey, I'd love to help.
What's a step-cousin?
So he's my stepfather's stepsister's son. So, yeah, no blood relation. He was just really adamant. He would joke with me and said he had the best kidney this side of the Mississippi and that he wanted to give it to me. Yeah.
How did it play out?
So obviously well, very well. I received his kidney on September 9th. But, you know, I remember we were in pre-op and everything, and I'm sure I had this huge smile on my face. And it was such an emotional couple of days because it was the culmination of something that you want and you wish for every day. You wake up and, man, what I would do and give to just be healthy. But yeah, I remember getting wheeled into the operating room and I had this like cheesy smile on my face and the anesthesiologist like, are you okay? And I was like, yeah, when I wake up, I'm getting a kidney. Like, I'm going to go to bed and I'm going to wake up and I'm going to have this kidney. And he's like, okay, but breathe. A few minutes later, you know, I was out and woke up and there it was.
I don't know what it's like to come out of anesthesia, but okay. Did you know where you were right away?
Oh, yes. Yes. And I instantly knew that. Like, okay, if all went well, there's a kidney in there. Well,
did you have to ask? You're like, is it in there?
Yeah, I was like, is it there? Like, you know, I
feeling
looked,
around.
Yeah, I was like, wait, are there stitches? Oh, okay, there's stitches. That's a good thing.
Wow. And so, how as you kind of came down from that euphoria, like, what was going through your mind about having this new part of your body?
Just so excited. So excited and elated and grateful, obviously, for my donor and doing this beautiful selfless act of his to help someone who was in need. And I mean, you know, he basically saved my life.
Does the organ feel like yours?
Yes and no.
Well, let me ask you a different way. Does it feel like you?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I've fondly named it the Hulk. Because it's such, it's very big and works wonderfully. My donor was a good sized guy, so he had a nice, big, healthy kidney. And it's funny because it's in the front, so I feel it. It's, you know.
Oh, you can feel it with your hand?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Get out.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. So do you unconsciously kind of touch it, or do you when you're thinking about it, do you reach down a little bit?
Yeah, both. And sometimes I just kind of hold it and just say thank you. Thanks, new friend, for doing all the good work that you're doing down there.
Layla and the Hulk live in Gig Harbor, and I checked in with her this week. She says they are both as healthy as can be. Just ahead, how Brian Peters decided that some protesters at last year's Seattle Pride Parade had messed with the wrong drag queen. That's coming up on Sound Effect right here on KPLU. This is Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This week, the joys of repetition, specifically the repetition of some of our favorite segments from our first 4 months of life. And this story is about Brian Peters. He got a lot of attention last year after this confrontation at Seattle's Pride Parade. And if his name doesn't sound familiar to you, it might be because he actually has another name which breaks some rules of its own, including some rules you may or may not have for the kind of language you want your kids to hear. So, earmuffs, guys. Brian Peters is also known as the drag queen Mama Tits. He spoke with KPLU's Ed Ronco in January, and as you might have guessed, this segment addresses some pretty adult topics.
So for those of you who've never been out here before, we are a crazy, wild, irreverent show, if you haven't figured out. I am goodness and light. I am nothing but sweet purity up here, and I will take you on this journey. It's everybody else you gotta watch out for. They're trash.
Could you describe yourself physically for people who can't see you?
Well, I'm 6'6". I weigh more than 250 pounds, but I actually wear my weight pretty evenly, thank God. So I'm big, stocky. I look like a linebacker. And my boobs are 44 triple D.
Oh, I forgot to tell you. I'm a dude. So if that changes things.
Do you consider yourself a rule breaker?
Completely. I'm one of those people that just because you tell me that that's the way things should be doesn't mean that I believe it. you know, I grew up in San Jose, Cupertino, San Rafael, and then we moved out later into Stockton, California. And, you know, I was one of four white kids. So it's like I've been on that end of it. I've been the first out gay male in my high school's history in Nampa, Idaho, when we left California and went to Idaho. Whoa. And I don't follow what I guess societal norm is. I just kind of follow the tune of my own drummer, and sometimes it gets me in trouble, sometimes it doesn't. You know, it's not what you say, it's how you say it.
Is performing in drag part of how you say it?
Oh my goodness. The way that drag is that I can then take myself, and aside from just wearing fabulous clothes and wigs and whatnot, I've completely covered who I am. And I wear this mask, and this mask of this character gives me this power of anonymity. And it's something I learned from being a Sister of Perpetual Indulgence, which is an organization based on rule breaking.
And the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, this is, just to clarify, a group that was founded in San Francisco. They dress up in drag as nuns and then go out into the streets and do good works.
They were the first ones to do the first candlelight vigil for AIDS victims. They were the first ones to organize pretty much everything that has happened in HIV/AIDS awareness and activism since it began in 1979. That was my what I consider boot camp. Because you can be angry about something and you can have something really upset you and you can want to make a change. But if you go about it the wrong way, you're going to do nothing but hinder your cause.
So I want to ask you about the Pride Parade, the most recent Pride Parade. You confronted some protesters that came down the street before the parade started. Describe what happened from your point of view.
This is the fifth year that I've hosted the Seattle Pride Parade. It's been a huge honor. They asked me as a sister 5 years ago. Sylvia Ostafermore actually asked me to join her. This year, we were invited to do Westlake Center, which was the pinnacle of the parade. And it's a huge honor. And we're in the pause between the pre-show and the actual parade. And I look down and I see these signs come around the corner. And I say to myself, I'm like, oh, hell no, because I can read these yellow signs that say, repent for your sins. And it was just all these little Bible-esque quotes of just damnation.
You thought that they had just kind of entered the parade route?
I thought they had just crashed the parade. I didn't find out that they had had a permit until weeks later. So I see them come around the corner, and I was livid. Mind you, I was in blue hair, aqua blue sequin dress, and a glitter rainbow on my boobs. And the next thing I know, they're in front of me. So I literally just throw my arms out as if I'm being nailed to a cross so that I'm a wall, a human wall. So he comes up and I get out, my arms are outstretched and I'm like, no, you're not passing me. And I keep jumping in front of him every time he tries to dodge me. And I was doing it to antagonize him so Seattle police would remove him. He got so frustrated with me, he ended up pushing on me. There was that moment where the photo captures me stepping to him. And then there's another photo of him just pressing on me. And right after that photo was snapped, he whacks me in the head with his sign. So I toss his sign out of his face and I let him go. And he walked up to the end and he ran into the Dykes on Bikes, which are the head of the Seattle Pride Parade. And they wouldn't let him pass. So he turned around and then is when the video starts picking up.
Why don't you read your own book and actually follow the teachings to the letter of God and learn to support and love? You need to drop the hate. You are a sad, sad excuse for a human being. Once you learn to drop the hate, you too can find happiness, because we will welcome you in open arms if you learn to open your mind.
What are you thinking as this is happening?
Be completely accountable for everything that you say.
Explain that.
The reason why I was mad at this man was he was not being accountable for the words that were coming out of his mouth. He was spewing vitriol and hate. And what I imagine in my head is the one person in the crowd, behind the crowd, this is the last thing they needed to hear. And they were trying to come out to a parade to be okay with themselves. Then they hear this and they go commit suicide. Or what about that person who hears it and they're like, that's all I needed, and they go do a gay bashing? Or what about the parent who is there trying to support their kid, but they hear this and then they're like, you know what? I can't do this. You're going to go to hell. And then now this kid doesn't have any family that loves and supports them. That's why I was angry, because I was like, you have commandeered our parade. we don't go to your revival and come in and start spewing how evil and nasty you are. We leave you alone. But you decide to come to our event that we have paid the city for, that we have permitted legally. And if you want your own, go ahead, do your own. But he couldn't get an audience. So he wanted to steal our audience. And that's what angered me. Is I was like, why? Why would you do that?
The YouTube clip as of December has like 1.8 million hits, give or take. Has it changed things for Mama or for Brian?
Wow. I woke up Monday morning and everybody knew who I was. It went global. I was just thinking about the fact that this man had upset me and he was not being accountable for his words, and I wanted him to be accountable, and I didn't want everybody to hear his hate. I was like, this is not what this is about. And then to wake up in the morning and have it hit so many people, it's truly humbling. It's like, holy God.
It affected you too.
Yeah. It was an extremely emotional day. Because I think of all of the people that have had to deal with this hate and didn't feel supported. All of the people that feel worthless. All the people that feel like something's wrong with them because they're not the way that somebody else told them that they should be. And it hurts me. Because I am proud to be a freak. I am proud to be a faggot. I am proud to be a queen. And through that, I am proud to be a survivor of abuse and HIV. I am proud of all of these things. I am not ashamed. And I don't want anybody else to be.
That's Brian Peters, also known as the drag queen Mama Tits. He spoke with KPLU's Ed Ronco for our show on Rule Breakers. And you can find a longer version of that interview at kplusoundeffect.org.
How's that, John?
It's repetition this week on Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This next piece comes from a show we did on failure, and this was kind of a melodic take on failure. So we invited this very unique band, appropriately named The Rejections, to KPLU's performance studio. And they are unique for a number of reasons, but chiefly among them, they are made up of some of Seattle's highest profile authors and some of their trailing spouses.
Okay, guys.
Okay. I'm Garth Stein. I play the electric bass, and I am an author of The Art of Racing in the Rain, as well as my latest book, A Sudden Light.
Matt Gurney, guitar number two, and trailing spouse of Jenny Shortridge, author.
Ben Bauermeister on fiddle. The trailing spouse of Erica Bauermeister.
I'm Paul Mars. I am the spouse of Laurie Frankel, the author, and I play guitar number one.
I am Stephanie Stevie Kalis. I'm the author of Broken For You, Sing Them Home, and Forthcoming, Language Arts, and I play piano and sing a little.
And I'm Jenny Shortridge. I'm an author of Love, Water, Memory, most recently, and I am the vocalist.
So Jenny Shortridge and Garth Stein, let me ask you a couple of quick questions about how you guys got together and everything. How do you guys know each other?
It all started in a coffee shop.
It started after a really botched reading that we, yeah, and Jenny and I did.
Where, ooh, a failure. It started after,
yes,
a failure?
Oh, absolutely. There was literally only trailing spouses in the house, and it was a very big house. Right? And so Jenny and I said, hey, let's get together for a cup of coffee and we can cry together, and that started the whole thing, right?
It did.
So where did the name of the band come from?
Honestly, we kind of modeled it on Stephen King's band, the Rock Bottom Remainders. You know, they had that band for a long time, and so every writer knows rejection, and so to have a band of authors, it just seemed natural to be Rejections.
Tell me even more explicitly, when you say you know rejection, what does that mean to you?
I think that authors are actually more the only artistic discipline where the authors are actually more insecure than actors. we sit in a room by ourselves for years. Poor hygiene. We just stare at a computer, don't really talk to people very much. We lose track of social skills. And then after a few years, we say, hey, look, I've got a stack of pages. Please love me. And then we are forced out into public.
It's just an occupational hazard, I think, for writers and for most creative types. And, you know, one of the hardest things is that now with Amazon and Goodreads, authors can go online and read zillions of reviews whereby they might not like your book very much. And so that's it gets harder and harder all the time with audience participation reviewing. And so you have to choose to either turn it off or to blow it off, or I don't know. What do you do, Garth?
With my last book, I was writing this for 2.5 years. I was writing this history of this timber family. And after 2.5 years, I had 100,000 words. And I said, this is great. This is my novel. And I sent it in, and my editor said, what on earth are you thinking? This is totally not your novel. And it took me a while to recover from that. And I had to really dig deep and understand that what I had been doing for 2.5 years is doing research for my novel. And so I was writing the history of this family, which then I set aside entirely and then wrote the book. But if I had set out in the beginning and said, oh, for 2.5 years, I'm going to do some character sketches, I never would have done it. I would have said, that's crazy. I'm going to go do something else for a living or something. So sometimes you do have to have that moment of rejection just to get the clarity of your own vision and to clarify what you're trying to say so that you can then, you know, hone your message.
So what do you guys get out of the music?
You know, there's something that happens when people all sing together. We tend to do a lot of harmonies because when you all sing together and all the instruments and the strings are vibrating together, it is a feeling that you can't get any other way, I don't think.
So could you guys take us out with something? You got a little something you can send us on our way with?
We'd love to. This is called Men of Luggage, and it's written by Paul Mars, one of our trailing spouses.
Check your coat, sit down and stay a while. Loosen your ties and up the rope to hang your sails. He's waiting on the nightstand when you're picking up the phone. I thought at least you would have figured out by now that same mistake that you'll make over and don't bury in the past and just digging up the graves. Don't feel bad, I know you'd fight it if you could. Making up the rivals who are knocking down your door. Don't hang around, they might be coming back for blood. That same mistake that you make over and over again.
That same
heartbreak that you'll make over and over again. So travel light, so travel light. Keeping out the cold, you carry that torch for yourself. And I warn you, the flame might just burn you at the touch. You don't want to hear about it all that much. So travel light. Try to retrace your steps. I do not think they'll be coming back for you. Men of luggage, it's okay. It's hard to live this life in your shoes. I don't know what I would do. That same mistake that you'll make over and over again. That same heartbreak that you'll make over and over again. So travel light. So travel light. So that same mistake that you make over and over again. So that same heartbreak that you make over and over again.
Well, I want to thank Jenny Shortridge, Matt Gani, Paul Maris, Stevie Kalis, Ben Bauermeister, and Garth Stein. They make up The Rejections. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and you're listening to Sound Effect. Today, we are rebroadcasting some of our favorite segments so far, and this next one is a dark one. It's got some disturbing descriptions in it, and it's not going to be appropriate for most kids. It's about 9 minutes long. So this piece comes from our episode on Northwest myths and legends, and it focuses on a lesser-known chapter of the infamous Green River Killer case. The story comes from Sound Effect's senior producer, Arwin Nix.
Do you remember where you were when you learned about the Green River Killer?
I was 12 years old. It was the summer of 1982. I was actually visiting my grandmother in eastern Washington in a small town called Winthrop, Washington. And so here I was, several hundred miles away from Seattle, and reading about this horror show that is happening to Seattle, that is taking place in Seattle, where the bodies of the first 3 to 4 victims were found in the Green River.
That's Jeff Jensen. He's an entertainment writer, and also the author of the book, Green River Killer, A True Detective Story.
Everyone always told me, you're going to write a book about your dad one day.
Everyone always told him that because his dad was the main detective on the Green River Killer case. And I had the chance to talk with Jeff recently when he came to visit his now retired police detective dad. We discussed the case and the murders and the toll he watched it take on his father and why he decided to write a graphic novel about the whole thing. But we focused on the end of his father's time on the case, and that's what his book focuses on. Because, as part of a plea deal, Gary Ridgway was moved into an office park at Boeing Field in the summer of 2003. And he lived there, on a mattress, in an empty room, with 24-hour armed guards at the door.
To go 20 years searching for this guy, to now just, like, coming to work every day and walking past Gary Ridgway in the morning, like, Gary? Tom?
It took 3 times longer than they thought it would to get the evidence they needed from Ridgway. Jeff's father, Detective Jensen, was there for all 188 long days of it. And when I spoke with Jeff, I asked him about his father's experience questioning Ridgway, and what that process was like.
What they encountered right away with him was this fuzzy memory, the imprecise recollection of each victim, sometimes certain memories of killing one person blurring into another, and an odd reticence to him. Like they couldn't quite figure him out. And over that first weekend of interviewing him, this thing emerged where it's like, why is he like this? Surely he should be able to remember. Why is he holding back on some things? And there were some things that in particular the detectives knew that they believed that the Green River Killer should know.
There is a breakthrough of the many breakthroughs that I want to ask you about. And it's when your father was questioning Gary Ridgway and he himself broke down
right
in the questioning. When was that in this timeline and what happened?
So on the morning of the fifth day, my father and another detective, John Mattson, led Gary into sort of like a conversation about any number of things. But the thing that they zeroed in on right away is necrophilia. So my father and John Mattson kind of conducted this interview in which they kind of like just made Gary feel safe and even empathized with him and kind of convinced him that this was something that he needed to disclose. And he went from admitting, yes, I did have sex with one body, to confessing that he had sex with several bodies. And my dad in particular, in that moment interviewing him, was feeling all of these things. I'm doing it. I'm getting a success. You know, where I'm getting somewhere with him. This is also really hard to hear. And now my father is feeling something else, which is guilt. Like, I'm doing it. I'm getting the success. But it's horrible what I'm hearing. I'm feeling proud about this. Like, what? The latter half of this morning conversation with Gary focused on one victim in particular, a victim that Gary claimed that he had some emotional attachment to, the victim Carol Christensen. There was oddities attached to her case that always nagged at my father, and so they got Gary to talk about killing this woman. And up until that point, Gary refused to really take responsibility for wanting to kill these women. He always blamed it on them. There was something about, like, he just wanted sex, and then they did something to not satisfy him, or he got scared, and he snapped, and he killed. And my father hated this kind of blame shifting.
He hated that Ridgway was saying these women triggered him, that it was their fault.
That's right. And what he wanted to hear from Gary is, I did it. I didn't just want to like have sex with these women. I wanted to destroy these women. My dad wanted to hear him take responsibility for destroying these lives. So he kind of led Gary down this sort of just very logical road of just making him aware, look, you knew what you were doing. You have responsibility for the pattern that you see emerging in your life. But you didn't do anything about stopping it. So you, from the moment you picked up these women, you knew you wanted to kill them, didn't you? And Gary finally said yes, and he finally confessed to that. And my hearing that just devastated my dad. It was what he wanted to hear, but it was also hard to hear. And he said in that moment, Gary, you've touched me. And he said, I need to take a break. And my dad, who, if you listen to the tape of him interviewing Gary during this session, he's struggling to keep it together. And he leaves and he goes to another room and he breaks down and cries.
Finally, Ridgway is convicted.
Yeah.
And your father can be done with this case that he's spent nearly 20 years working on.
Yeah.
What was that like for your father once Ridgway was finally put away for these murders?
My dad says that there's only been a handful of times in this whole case that he has shed tears over it. One was that morning on the fifth day when he got Gary to confess to the things that he confessed to. But one of the other times was on the day in which he finally was in court and heard Gary Ridgway plead guilty to all of these things, and he cried, and it was just be able to finally release all of the emotions, frustrations of 20 years of keeping it all inside and being strong and tough for his family, for his community, for the case, to be at the end of it. I mean, it was just catharsis for a lot of complicated emotions that I don't think we have words for, you know.
Jeff Jensen is the author of Green River Killer, A True Detective Story, and he spoke with Sound Effects senior producer Arwin Nix. This last repeat we have for you is from our show on Vice. And for this one, we tried to think about what it would be like if the people who are closest to you, and if you're a kid, of course, that's probably going to be your parents, considered something really essential about you to be a vice. That's the situation Danny Cords found himself in when he came out as gay to his parents at age 14. Danny grew up in a very religious home in a semi-rural setting in Renton, and the conversation did not go well. His mother was encouraged by a pastor to put Danny into conversion therapy. It's also called reparative therapy. And it's this program of counseling that's meant to get Danny to overcome this vice of his. The vice, of course, being homosexuality. And the implication of that, of course, is that one can turn from gay to straight. So Danny went to this therapy once, sometimes twice a week, for 3 years. And when I talked to him earlier this year, he told me how the first conversation with his conversion therapist went.
So we had to go all the way to Tacoma to find this therapist who sat me down. And one of the first things that he wanted to figure out was whether I was a top or a bottom, which, of course, are sexual positions. I was 14. I had no idea. I hadn't had sex.
Why did he want to know that? That's such a strange thing.
It is strange. It was through this theory, and he was very open about this, that if you're a top, then you are obviously on this level of heterosexuality in some form. Like, if you're a bottom, you're completely submissive.
Oh, so if you're a bottom, you're identifying more with a submissive, I see, or kind of, quote, feminized kind of a position.
Exactly.
And then there's no helping you at all? Or?
Well, it wasn't that there was no helping you. It's just that you would require more therapy, and that they would have to really work at you, and you might have to go to some of the camps that they had back then or some of the workshops that they had.
What else did the therapy consist of?
It was fear-based. So there was a Bible verse, but basically something, something, you'll become the slums of the earth. And he asked me if I'd ever been to Capitol Hill once outside of a field trip. And he asked me if there were any homeless people there and drug addicts and whatever. And I said, yes. And he's like, well, there you go.
So tell me more about what happened in the sessions when you were given these sort of this homework and ways to try and change your behaviors. What kind of homework were you given?
So the motto of the therapy was all things are possible through Christ. So prayer. For me, it was this, what it meant for me was this pocket cross that came with a card and you keep it in your pocket. And whenever you had temptations or bad feelings, you were supposed to grab it in your pocket and recite the prayer. The more I think about this and the more I reflect on the pocket cross and what that meant for me, because I had it for years, is you hold it in your hand. And I think I kept my hand probably in my pocket on that cross for most of the day as a way for me to redirect focus to God away from whatever, musical theater. And then there was the rock in your shoe, which is, it was similar to the cross, but it was supposed to be that poking at you so that you didn't have to grab it and hold it and remember it, that it would do it for you, that you would always know and you'd have that, not quite pain, but discomfort.
What was this supposed to make you think of?
For me as a kid, every day going through conversion therapy, I thought, felt, did all these things that I wasn't supposed to. Every moment was me. The rock in my shoe was trying to change that.
And was it variations on that theme that whole time for how long, like 3 years?
It was actually, so there was a lot of gloom and doom. And then there was a lot of talking about the Bible and talking about me and talking about the way I formed male relationships. But for this one in particular, it was more cognitive behavioral. So take a behavior, get to know what's behind it, and then change it.
The way that this made you think about yourself, did you believe it? Did you sort of buy into it?
The counselor was not very convincing. I was being confirmed in the Lutheran Church at the time, and he would misquote the Bible. So I didn't believe him, but what did happen is that I didn't believe in myself anymore. Nothing mattered. And I really did stop caring about school, about friends. I isolated. I got incredibly depressed.
So while all this was going on, I mean, you had a lot of other challenges in your life too. What was that like? What was your school like? What was your home life like as you're kind of struggling with your own sexual identity?
Sure. Well, I didn't explicitly come out in high school, but people are smart and they figure things out. So I was bullied quite a bit in school. So there would be times when I'd be in the lunchroom and somebody would spit on me and the lunchroom lady would see it and not do anything. Or, you know, I'd be followed, you know, followed home. We'd walk through the horse trails and people would follow me, yell at me, whatever. Or follow me in my car, tailgate me, flash their lights.
In the midst of all that, what was it about the therapy in particular that affected you as opposed to all this other stuff? I mean, you had kind of an us versus them thing in a lot of parts of your life.
Well, when you go to a therapy that becomes your entire life, and then you're bullied and your parents don't support what you want to do or be or who you are, then there isn't much point to living.
How did that progress for you, and your what was your state of mind like?
I eventually came to ends with my parents, and I left home at 17, my senior year of high school, and I was on my own, and it just got worse. I knew that inside I was this hollow person, and so I one night just made a plan to end it and commit suicide.
What do you want to say about that?
I think the most important thing to bring up when talking about suicide attempts is just that, and in relation to therapy, is that who I was taken from me that first week that I was in therapy. When you put it all together and you look at it holistically, you have parents who don't know what to do. They put you in therapy and they question who you are. What you are, and you start to question who you are, what you are, and no one has answers for you, and there's no role models. And then you go to school, and people bully you, and you're still receiving therapy, and your parents still don't know what to say, almost at no fault of their own. So it really muddies up where you find your value and where you find your self-worth. It's almost a wonder I didn't do it sooner.
You made it. How did you emerge from that chapter?
Good question. Because I still suffer from brain damage from my attempted suicide. And I think that part of me died, that part of me that didn't value myself, that part of me that questioned myself, that part of me that worried about what somebody or some kind of therapy or therapist thinks about me.
What was it about the therapy that you feel like robbed you of your self-worth?
I mean, it's a lot of things. But mostly this concept of the way you dress, the way you talk, the way you like show tunes is wrong. That if you don't change, that it's your fault. And that somehow all things are possible through Christ, but Christ must not love you enough to do anything about it, even though you are praying constantly.
I guess finally, you've come to terms with your own parents' beliefs about this. But what about parents who are going through this now? What would you say to them? What advice would you give to them, to a parent who's confronting this with their own kid?
So I want to first say that my parents are really good people. And I think that is really important to point out, because what they did out of ignorance and they did out of fear. So for parents, when their son comes out of the closet or daughter comes out of the closet, for whatever that closet may be, they need to sit down and take a couple deep breaths and really research and get out into the community. And whatever that means, online. I mean, we have the internet. It's wonderful. And to do your homework before you do anything, I mean, it's one of those hard things because there's so much emotion and passion built into this and fear. But you have to look at it holistically. Otherwise, you can't make an informed decision.
Danny Cords was in conversion therapy from age 14 to 17, and now he advocates banning conversion therapy for minors. It's a practice that's still legal in Washington state. There was a bill that would have outlawed it, but it passed the state house this session and then died in the Senate. We decided to give the last word to Danny and the group that he credits with helping him come into his own. It's the Seattle Men's Chorus. And here's a bit of Danny singing. It's from the production I Am Harvey Milk. Hey, funny you should mention that, Danny Cords / Harvey Milk. Next week on our show, we're exploring the theme of coming out. Coming out about all sorts of things and why it's so easy to get stuck between in and out.
And I'm not like one of those like quiet gays either. I'm like one of those like, you know, I'm gay, you know.
Sound Effect is produced by Arwin Nix and Kevin Kniestad. Thanks to Ed Ronco for his story, both times, and a little Kisau. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. You can get our podcast on iTunes and write us a review while you're there. Really, even just a few words would help a lot. Meanwhile, tell us what you think of the show. Email soundeffect@kplu.org or tweet @KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.